So this is how it must have sounded when it began. It's the sound of a pair of Black Hawk helicopters taking off. And anyone could have heard that sound if they were hanging around Jalalabad, Afghanistan last May 1st. They wouldn't have seen anything, though. The choppers took off in darkness, and there were no lights. And they probably wouldn't have known what they had witnessed until this announcement to the world.
I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children.
Between those two moments, an extraordinary story unfolded, the details of perhaps the most successful covert operation in U.S. history. The first draft of that story, the first draft of history these days, comes in electronic images, generally. In this case, there were some night vision drone pictures, some incomplete statements from various officials. We remember the first drafts. We reported some of them. But real journalism is maybe more like a third draft of history these days, and an astoundingly complete picture of that raid that killed Osama bin Laden is in this week's New Yorker, entitled simply Getting Bin Laden, What Happened That Night in Abbottabad. Nicholas Schmidl, fellow at the New America Foundation, is the author of that article and joins us now. Nicholas, congratulations, first of all.
Thanks, John.
Amazing access. Give us a little bit of a roadmap of your access, and I want to do this conversation in two parts. We'll, in our second part, give a sense of the chronology of the raid, but I want to talk about what this raid really represented. What sort of access did you get?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned, there the framework of the story had already been out there for some time, you know, since essentially the morning of or late on the night of May 1st. And so with that framework, I was able just to be able to sort of go about recreating from about a half dozen up to 10 sources who were deeply familiar and knowledgeable of what went down that night. And just by building on each of them, was able to sort of get another small detail here, another small detail there, and it all worked out in the end.
And particularly access to the SEAL Team 6 folks who actually were directly involved in the raid. First of all, this was the culmination of a lot of raids, a lot of rehearsals, and a lot of actual penetration of Pakistani territory, we learn in this article, that hasn't been reported before.
That's right. I mean, there's a couple of things. And you mentioned this is the culmination of a lot of raids. I mean, the general narrative that came out after on May 2nd onwards was that this was sort of one of three, that you had Operation Eagle Claw, the failed attempt to rescue the hostages in Iran in 1980. Then you had Black Hawk Down, and then you had this. And this was the proof that Special Forces finally had, or you know, Special Operations Forces had finally figured out how to do it. But a lot of people I spoke to said that, no. I mean, this is one of, on this particular evening, this is one of 13 nighttime raids that were launched from Afghanistan. And 12 of them went into Afghanistan. Someone said 12 of them went left, and one of them just happened to go right.
Wow. And the ability of the teams now to improvise when things go awry, and we'll talk about that a little bit later when that chopper went down in the compound, but this ability to improvise has really raised the level of capability, wouldn't you say?
Definitely. And it's part of the whole, I mean, the fact that these guys are doing it night in and night out for the past 9 years, 10 years, means that just very little takes them by surprise anymore. I mean, they've seen it all in many cases.
And we'll see how that benefited them when we actually talk about the moment by moment of the raid. But, you know, the other really interesting context here is that this raid represents, and you portray it beautifully in the New Yorker piece. Nicholas Schmidl is the author of the New Yorker piece. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation. That this is the perfect kind of merging of CIA military ops, JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, which is sort of this other, armed service in the Pentagon, and the 21st century military. And Obama has managed to achieve it on his watch. Would you agree?
He has, and I think that it is. It has gradually gotten better. I think that it has all sort of come together. It has all come together under Obama, but you have to sort of wonder whether these guys on the ground would have also figured this out under another administration, for instance. And I guess what it goes back to this. It goes back to the operational tempo that these guys have maintained over the past few years. I mean, Afghanistan 01, 02, early Iraq 2003. Many of them were still very many of them being sort of the CIA folks, the JSOC folks, were very territorial as to who did what. And now with one tour after another, I mean, these guys are showing up in Afghanistan. They've already done 3, 4, 5 tours with each other in Iraq and Afghanistan over the course of the past 9 years. And those lines have just increasingly blurred and or they've sort of dissolved altogether.
And they're in secret offices there at Langley in Virginia at CIA headquarters. Bob Gates was against this raid. Barack Obama decided to go for it.
Right. You know, the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, was in the CIA in the National Security Council in 1980 when they were planning Operation Eagle Claw. And, you know, he was sources that were inside of the White House discussions told me that he made a comment at one point that, you know, that sounded like a pretty good idea at the time, too.
And that was the Carter abortive rescue of the hostages in Iran, right?
Exactly. And that ended up with 8 dead Americans in the deserts of Iran. It was just a debacle. And so you're right. You know, he pushed against it or he favored other courses of action. But the president favored the raid option for a number of reasons.
Nicholas Schmidl is a fellow at the New America Foundation and author of this article in the New Yorker magazine called Getting Bin Laden. So, Nicholas, perhaps part of this success is also due to a shifting of investment from on-the-ground warfare, traditional warfare with deploying army forces and tanks, to this more covert tactics as just a general way of using the military.
Right. Well, I think that, I mean, there are a couple of pieces to that. I think that, as we're 9 years into our involvement in Afghanistan, and I think that the administration knows that the public is tiring of the war, and so they're looking for ways to strike that symbolic blow. And, you know, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000 troops on the ground in southern Afghanistan don't do that quite like a raid into the heart of al-Qaeda that sort of takes out their leader and then takes his body out of the country and ultimately, you know, deposits him in the ocean.
Well, stay with us. We're going to take you into the Situation Room and aboard that chopper that got bin Laden. Getting Bin Laden, What Happened That Night in Abbottabad. It's the article in this week's edition of The New Yorker magazine. We're talking with the author, Nicholas Schmidl. He's a fellow at the New America Foundation. Stay with us, Nick. We're going to continue our conversation with Nicholas Schmidl, who's a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of To Live or to Perish Forever, Two Tumultuous Years Inside Pakistan. He's also the author of the article in this week's New Yorker called Getting Bin Laden, What Happened That Night in Abbottabad. And it's a story of that raid, probably the most successful covert operation in U.S. history. Nicholas, they were sure, or at least 95% sure, and you make the case in the article of how the intelligence actually unfolded. But when they were sure, they went. Describe the liftoff of those 2 Black Hawks and what happened then.
Well, and I just to come back real quick, I mean, there were some within the CIA who were 95% sure, but the range of confidence was about 60 to 80%.
Wow.
And the president would later tell the SEALs that he was only 50% sure that actually bin Laden was in the house. So there was a great deal of uncertainty, in fact, even that once they got there, once they penetrated 160 miles inside of Pakistani territory, and once these SEALs descended from the fast ropes into the compound, whether bin Laden was going to be upstairs. So that added a certain element of uncertainty to the whole thing. But so the helicopters, 2 Black Hawk helicopters left from a section of Jalalabad Airfield reserved for JSOC, for the Joint Special Operations Command, and flew essentially due east from Jalalabad onto Abbottabad.
And they penetrate Pakistani air defenses because they're stealthily sort of equipped, and there are apparently holes in Pakistan's air defenses. And somebody speculates that they're mostly looking at India, so they probably weren't looking that way. But for one way or another, they get to Abbottabad. What was the route that they took?
Well, the route that they took essentially was just following the backside of the mountains that come northeast from Jalalabad and then hook around to Abbottabad. So, yes, the helicopters were modified to hide heat, noise, movement, and they did have some sort of high-tech, you know, radar dampening skin and whatnot. But really, they just followed they used the natural contours of the land to be able to hide behind.
They had 90 minutes to think about the mission as they took this flight. They arrive close to the compound, and they start loading their weapons. What happens next?
Well, the idea was that there were 2 helicopters, and the idea was that the first helicopter was going to fly over the compound, and it was going to drop 12 SEALs into the inner courtyard. The second helicopter was going to drop. The second helicopter was going to stay to the northeast corner, just outside of the compound. Was going to drop 4 SEALs, the translator, and the dog that they had brought along, and then was going to hover above the third floor and drop its 7 SEALs onto the third floor. What happened, though, didn't was show that the plan sort of went awry, and the fact that the first helicopter experienced mechanical problems and ultimately went in for a crash landing.
So what happened in the Situation Room when they observed from drone images essentially that crash?
Well, I think that iconic picture probably captures the moment as well as anywhere. You know, Secretary of State Clinton is holding her mouth, and everyone just looks absolutely riveted by what they're watching at the time. So it's hard to know at what point that photo was taken, but they watched the helicopter essentially crash inside of the compound, and I think that everyone's worst fears that had been articulated by Secretary Gates in the previous weeks and months were certainly pinging about in the back of their minds.
But the soldiers in that helicopter, they get out, they have their C4 and their explosives, they go about their business. Give me the code name of who they were looking for.
So the code name, they had devised this checklist that followed, an alphabetized checklist that followed a Native American theme. And the seventh item on that checklist was Geronimo, and that was to signify that they had actually found bin Laden. But for the past 9 years, the folks within JSOC had a target name for bin Laden, which is what they referred to him in the briefings and whatnot, and that target name was Crankshaft.
And so they were looking for Geronimo and Crankshaft, and if they heard those words back in Langley or back in the White House Situation Room, they would know what was going on.
They would know that the SEALs had found bin Laden, that's correct.
All right, so take us into the building. They blew up some gates to get past stairways and made their way up to the third floor.
That's correct. So they had broken off into three-man teams, and one three-man team was making its way up the stairs, had blasted through the metal gate blocking their entrance, made their way up the stairs, came to the top of the stairs, and there was a bit of a landing. The first SEAL looks right and sees this tall individual poking his head out the door, long sort of fist-length beard, and knows immediately that it's bin Laden. So the three of them proceed down the hallway, push open the door, and when they come into the room, there are two women standing in front of bin Laden, and one of them is his fifth wife, Amal. We don't know exactly who the second woman is, but Amal was hysterical and began charging the first SEAL, and there was a concern at that point that she and or the other woman could be wearing suicide vests. And so this first SEAL, first he shoots Amal once in the calf to disable her, and then he steps forward and wraps both women in a bear hug and drives them off to the side.
The idea, if there is an explosive vest, he would have taken the blast and the other SEALs would have survived.
Right. I mean, just incredible, incredible, incredible self-sacrifice, right? So the second SEAL, then once the women are moved out of the way, the second SEAL comes in. And this is all happening sort of split second. I mean, there was no sort of dirty, hairy moment or anything. Second SEAL comes into the room and shoots bin Laden once in the chest. Bin Laden begins falling back, once in the head. Bin Laden hits the ground, and that's it. He gets on his radio, and he says, "For God and country, Geronimo, Geronimo, Geronimo." There's a slight pause, and then he says, "Geronimo, EKIA, enemy killed in action." And that was it.
And Barack Obama's response when he heard that?
He says, "We got him," sort of to no one in particular, just simple statement of fact. And there was no, at that point, there was no high-fiving or anything. It was just a very kind of almost a solemn declaration.
And in the compound, they start collecting all of the intelligence and put it in bags, put Osama, in that body bag.
Right.
And there's a discussion of what they were going to do with the body that's in your article, which I urge people to read. What was the elapsed time when they took off to head back?
Well, they still needed to make the 90-minute flight back, but what else they needed to do was that the Black Hawk that had been on target now for 40 minutes and was flying with the exact sort of the amount of fuel that it thought it needed to get to the target in order to stay light needed to refuel. And they had there were two Chinook helicopters that had, while the Black Hawks had taken off about 45 minutes later, they too had crossed into Pakistan and had settled down in a remote valley. And one of them was the refueling helicopter. So this Black Hawk, the remaining one that did not crash, still needed to go find that other Chinook, sit down in this valley, and for 25 minutes refuel to make sure it had enough to get back to Afghanistan.
What was the elapsed time on the ground in the compound before we go?
38 minutes.
Barack Obama met the SEAL team. They gave him a flag that came in on one of those chompers.
Right.
But there was one piece of information that the president didn't learn.
Right. He never asked who fired the kill shot, and none of them volunteered the information.
You know, though, right?
I don't.
You don't?
I don't.
If you did know from your reporting and the president called, would you tell him?
These guys, I don't know that I would, actually.
Nicholas Schmidl, fascinating access, fascinating story, a great narrative. It's all in this week's New Yorker. He's the author of Getting Bin Laden, What Happened That Night at Abbottabad. Congratulations, Nate.
Thanks a bunch.
Nicholas Schmidl is a fellow at the New America Foundation. So we're going to spend just a couple more minutes with Nicholas Schmidl, who's a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of this piece in this week's New Yorker called Getting Bin Laden, What Happened That Night in Abbottabad. I mean, basically, we can't bear to hang up on you, Nick, after that conversation. For the last couple of minutes that we have here, though, tell us about, and it's something that you convey in the article, the conflicting accounts in the story that comes naturally, you discovered, from the tiny slices of the story that each of the Navy SEALs has, the information that intelligence officials are getting, which again is a slice, the adrenaline that's flowing, and the fact that they kept this pretty tightly bound in a very, very small group of people who actually knew everything that was going on.
Right. I mean, I think that in the days after the raid, there was a sense of trying to get there was a sense of trying to get out a story that somehow removed questions about there were some questions of legality of the raid itself. And I think that they were trying to sort of, you know, paint it as being a firefight or it just was unneeded. I just think that the story, that I understand the rush to get the information out, but as you see here, I mean, the story, these guys, there was no need to sort of to add anything to the heroicness of the story by itself. But you're right. In the course of reporting it, I mean, very, very, very credible sources in the military, intelligence community, et cetera, were offering conflicting accounts of very definitive points along the raid.
And there was this report that CBS actually went with, that there were helmet cameras, which you discovered actually was not the case, that there was really just one real-time camera. Where was it?
Yeah, no, that's true. That there were no helmet cameras. The notion that those in the Situation Room were watching, you know, a video game sort of, you know, a helmet cam of these guys running through the house was not the case. There was a single unmanned drone flying above the compound that was providing real-time overhead aerial footage of the compound, but otherwise that was it.
What was the just sort of general demeanor of the SEAL team members that you talked to about the success and what it meant both for their team, for the Navy, and really for the U.S. military?
Well, I mean, I talked to a number of people again who were intimately involved in the raid. I don't want to give the impression that these guys are really the concern over their safety and security and their identities is being held so closely that you know, trying to get access to them was all but impossible. But the sense now is I think that people feel like a precedent has been set, particularly people in the special operations community, that, as one of them said, you know, if we can go 160 miles into Pakistan to do this, we can certainly knock off some of the guys who are just in the tribal areas that are only, say, 5 miles across the border. So I do think that there's an increased confidence in the ability of the military, and particularly in the ability of those elements within JSOC, the sort of the black operations, to be able to pull off things like this.
And with Panetta now heading the Pentagon and Petraeus at the CIA, it makes these raids even more seamless and more possible.
One would think for sure that line between the military and the intelligence community has increasingly blurred, for sure.
I mean, if you're an admiral on an aircraft carrier, you're kind of out of luck these days, huh?
You have to wonder, for sure.
That's a theory, anyway. Nicholas Schmidl, a fellow at the New America Foundation, author of a piece in this week's New Yorker, Getting Bin Laden, What Happened That Night in Abbottabad. Nick, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.